ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Dr. Ann Jones here. I've been out and about recording nature sounds, but nature doesn't always oblige. For example, this wombat, yes, you, thought that my recorder was the perfect place to scratch its butt. So to find out what else that wombat got up to one night near Canberra, subscribe to Nature Sounds by Ann Jones on ABC Listen, on podcast apps, and also on the Wombat Butt Scratching Thumbs Up list.
Hello and welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. I'm David Rutledge. It's great to have you along this week for a conversation that I've been wanting to have for a little while now. The great German philosopher Jürgen Habermas died in March at the age of 96. And over the following couple of weeks, it was really interesting to read the obituaries of Habermas, the think pieces about Habermas, and to see how many of them posed variations on the same question. Does the passing of Jürgen Habermas also mark the passing of the age that he lived through and the hopes and the ideals that he championed in his philosophy? Habermas was a multifaceted thinker. He wrote dozens of books across a seven-decade career, exploring politics, law, communication, social theory, ethics, religion, secularism. But if there's one thread that can be said to run through all of his work, it's a commitment to a particular kind of reason. Habermas was an Enlightenment guy, and he believed in the capacity of people to reach mutual understanding through rational argument in the public domain. But if this faith in reasoned consensus is the single idea that grounds his thinking, it's also one of his most contested ideas, as well as being one that seems to sit awkwardly in today's public sphere, where polarization and deliberate disinformation and rage baiting and algorithmic media that rewards the opposite of consensus are all so characteristic of public discourse that it seems almost perverse to insist that we can all come together and debate rationally in the search for truth and mutual understanding. Well, of course, Habermas himself was aware of this tension, but it's not the kind of tension that you can just simply resolve by thinking it through. And the question still remains, did Jürgen Habermas's death also mark the end of his vision of democratic life? Well, as it happens, that question is actually a quote. It's the title of a recent essay about Habermas published on the ABC Religion and Ethics website. And it's such a great piece of writing that I had to invite the author onto the show to talk about it. Peter Voroshek is Senior Assistant Professor in the History and Theory of European Integration at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands, and he joins me now. Peter, welcome to the Philosopher's Zone.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm a long-time listener, so it's a pleasure to be with you.
Good to hear. Now, in Habermas's final writings, he refers to what is generally translated into English as the uncanniness of the times, which, you know, that German word, Unheimlichkeit, it's an interesting one. It has connotations of creepiness, maybe a kind of unease that uncanny maybe doesn't quite capture. What is Habermas referring to in that phrase?
Yeah, so I mean, it's a phrase that has quite a kind of long history in philosophy, even though it's originally a kind of psychoanalytic phrase that Freud popularized. And it was taken up by Heidegger and a lot of other philosophers. And you're right, it gets at this kind of creepiness, but really, I think the sort of most direct English translation would be kind of unhomeliness, right? Heim is home. So it's the sense of like the feeling that you're at home, but that something's a little bit off, right? That sort of there's almost like, you know, in a dream or in a nightmare, right? Where you're at home, but you have the sense, right, that something is coming. that something's a little bit off. And that's really what the way Habermas is using the term. And I think for him, it really expresses sort of the sense that in the current moment, right, all the kind of structures and institutions and practices of the post-war and even kind of the post-Cold War world are still there, right? I mean, sort of despite all kinds of predictions and Brexit, the European Union is still there, NATO is still there, right? Despite Trump's attacks, the WTO is still around, right? Everything kind of seems like it's in place, right? Even the institutions of American democracy formally are still functioning, right? Despite sort of all the attacks, right? And I think the same is true almost everywhere else, right? Kind of all the structures and institutions at first glance, everything looks like it looks like nothing has changed. And yet, right, over the past decade in particular, there is this sense that sort of in the background or sort of behind the kind of facade of normalcy, that things really are changing, right? That a rupture is coming of some kind, right? I think sort of that's perhaps even more intense for a lot of people now with the rise of AI and worries about job losses, right? Not being able to even tell what texts have been written by humans, when you're communicating with a human, when you're not, right? So it's supposed to capture that kind of unease and that almost appearance that a familiar environment is no longer familiar, right? Or that there is something creeping up behind us, that there's going to be this rupture in this area that we think we know. And I think that's really what Habermas is trying to capture. And in particular, I think sort of he spoke a number of times in the few years before his death that he had this feeling that kind of the world that he had worked so hard to sort of help construct and understand, and that his life work in many ways was being lost step by step, right? That his attempts to sort of think through a more rational, a more kind of rules-based order, that was almost being lost, and that he almost found it, you know, this kind of tragedy that he was living through that loss. And even in some of his last writings, I mean, Habermas was always a very controversial figure as a public intellectual and public commentator, but even in his last writings or in some interviews, he said that sort of in the last years that for the first time, he really felt that he no longer even understood the reactions of the German public anymore. Right. And again, that was for him the sense of like that he was still a German, still lived in Germany, very much sort of in the German atmosphere, but that somehow the responses he was getting no longer made sense to him. And again, I think that's really capturing this kind of idea of unhomeliness, right? This kind of creeping sense of dread.
And I guess the home for Habermas, as for most Western Europeans, was liberal democracy. And of course, and he was a great defender of democracy for all of his life. In your essay, I mean, you suggest that the death of Habermas marks the symbolic end of the post-war democratic settlement itself. That's giving him a lot of historical importance. Why do you see his death as carrying that kind of significance?
Yeah, well, as I said, I mean, I think it is in some sense a symbolic end, right? And, you know, maybe the historians of the future will sort of see that as a kind of bookmark. And I think that he did provide a lot of kind of intellectual scaffolding and a lot of even sort of justification for how to think about that order and think about what was really happening there. And I think sort of we talk in the popular press about this idea of the rules-based international order, and Habermas doesn't use that phrase, but some of his core ideas, I think, capture and sort of try to justify the basic idea there. So in a lot of his work, especially after kind of the fall of the Berlin Wall, he talks about his project as being really rooted in what he calls the constitutionalization of international law. And that's the idea that he was really invested in this attempt to turn international law from something that was customary and sort of perhaps recognized more in its abuse than in its actual application, into something that actually had teeth and that could be compared to kind of standard administrative law within the state, right? That actually can be coercively enforced. And I think sort of you see that kind of idea in sort of the ICJ and the rise of sort of a lot of these kind of international criminal courts. And also he was a big supporter of what lawyers or international relations scholars refer to as the move from international law towards cosmopolitan law. And that's the idea that international law, right, is the law between states. Individuals have no standing in international law, right? Only states do. The idea of cosmopolitan law is this idea that if my rights are sort of infringed upon by another state and I cannot sort of get redress from that state's court system, that it can actually use international legal structures as an individual to sort of sue that state or to sort of get redress. Right, so he was a big supporter of these kind of ideas, and I think those are ideas that are very much rooted in the rules-based international order. And then for him, the other big phrase that I think sort of he tried to popularize in the big idea was this idea of the post-national constellation. And that captures a lot of really fundamental ideas in his thought. The first is his real conviction regarding the dangers of nationalism and his moves to what he called the kind of constitutional patriotism, right? This idea that our sense of belonging should not be rooted in pre-political ideas of race or ethnicity or even language as such, but that they really should be rooted in a sort of civic commitment to the Constitution, right? Just sort of the basic ideas that undergird our living together in whichever state we are in. And the post-national constellation, in addition to building on that sort of domestic political identitarian idea, also then roots his support of the EU because he thought that sort of in an age of ever-growing economic globalization, right, where you have multinational corporations that are able to sort of operate above and beyond the nation state and really sort of drive a kind of race to the bottom, and where international financial markets are able to dictate policy to individual states, right? I think sort of you saw that in Greece during the Eurozone crisis and in any number of other areas. Habermas really thought that politics had to catch up with economics, and that sort of politics had to move up to the kind of the post-national level and to a more global level in order to be able to sort of really face down the global forces of economics. And so he saw the EU as almost a forerunner of a kind of politics where we would have these big regimes that had at least some kind of shared history, as Europe does, right, with experiences of war and sort of even of historical movements, that you could see those continental regimes coming together and establishing a new kind of politics where, instead of being a politics of anarchy, where sort of individual states would really be responding to the demands of the market, that these bigger regimes could then sort of negotiate a global domestic policy, and that's an idea he borrows from Kant, with each other to really sort of make sure that economics did not escape from the containment of politics. And I think sort of a lot of those ideas, they weren't taken up as Habermasian ideas, but I think he did, those ideas really provided a lot of the intellectual foundation and a way of thinking about what the post-war order was trying to achieve. And in that sense, I think sort of Habermas's death does symbolize or can be almost taken to sort of reflect a kind of end of those kind of optimistic ideals of this kind of post-war rules-based international order.
Yeah, and of course, these ideals, these commitments of Habermas have deep roots in his early life. He was, of course, a German philosopher, which has to be significant. Can you outline the significance of that, of his Germanness for us?
I mean, I think the fact that he was German was very significant, right? I think sort of the background of any philosopher or any thinker is always significant. But I think perhaps just as important, or I think sort of you can't speak about Habermas as a German without also speaking of him as a German who was born in 1929 and who sort of grew up in the Third Reich and Nazi Germany, right? So I think the timing or his generation is just as important as the fact of his Germanness. Habermas sort of talks about 1945 as being this real revelation, right, where he would go to the cinema to see the news broadcasts, and that at that point, for the first time, he really realized that he had grown up in a criminal regime. Right, and that was a real revelation for him, that he had been able to live his youth without necessarily recognizing that. And it really caused him to kind of question a lot of German traditions and even sort of really think about what it meant that sort of his childhood had seemed normal, even though it had been the Third Reich, the Holocaust was happening, there had been war. And he really thought that that was a sign that change was needed and that we really needed to think carefully. And so for him, you know, he's been referred to as a prototypical example of a non-German German, right? The German who wanted to use the experience of 1945 as a way to rebuild Germany as a universal sort of post-national republic. And in that sense, right, his Germanness and his generational identity really root his sort of attempt to sort of understand his own experience, which is very particular and rooted in that time and place, and try to sort of draw out universal lessons from it, right? About the dangers of nationalism, about the dangers of fascism, authoritarianism, and really sort of what that means for how we need to always be aware of the fact that the normalcy of our lives can really be hiding really dangerous tendencies, and that we always need to be sort of looking at who are the voiceless, who is being abused, right? And really maintain that awareness. And also, I think it roots his idea that we not only need to learn from catastrophe, but that also, hopefully, this is, I think, the hopeful aspect of his ideas, that other people can learn from the catastrophes that occur elsewhere, right? So this also, I think, roots his idea that the Holocaust, while being a very particular German experience, is also an experience that hopefully the rest of the world can learn from without having to repeat the Holocaust in other parts of the world, right? So that's, in some sense, this dialectic of universal in particular, where particular experiences can ground some forms of universal learning.
And all of this ideally takes place for Habermas within a sort of rational public sphere. Very much, you know, he's really sort of drawing on some classic Enlightenment values here. And what interests me is that we have this thread running through political philosophy today that interrogates so-called Enlightenment values and finds them wanting, you know, the argument being that our long-standing faith in universal reason and progress and objective truth is starting to look a little naive, or at least no longer fit for purpose. Habermas always insisted that the Enlightenment was not a failure, but more of an unfinished project. What exactly did he mean by that?
Yeah, I think sort of that phrase, which has become very much associated with Habermas, I think really reflects his idea that the sort of very clear and obvious problems with the Enlightenment, right, and sort of, you know, the rise of the Enlightenment and of the universalism it proclaimed came at the same time as sort of the rise of imperialism, the rise of capitalism, of racism, colonialism, right, and all these kind of big problems. And for Habermas, he doesn't want to deny those problems. In fact, he wants to confront them. But he still thinks that those problems do not mean that we need to abandon the Enlightenment as such. And I think sort of that really reflects his the differences that he had with sort of more postmodern streams that are of thought that are usually associated with kind of the French traditions, where Habermas really, he sort of wanted to almost use the negative sides of the Enlightenment, again, as an opportunity for learning and as a way to almost reaffirm the universal values that he still thought were valuable from the Enlightenment, right? So for him, the fact that the Enlightenment coincided with the rise of imperialism and colonialism was not an argument against the Enlightenment, but it was an argument for sort of thinking further about how we could actually instantiate the values of the Enlightenment that he still thought had real potential in the world. And so I think, again, right, this was, it's often said, I think, that that Germans, sometimes it's speculated that it's because of the structure of the language, right, that allows you to bring concepts together into new words, that Germans are synthesizers. And I think, again, this is sort of Habermas's attempt to synthesize or to take kind of middle road between kind of the critiques of the Enlightenment, right, that want to abandon it completely, and its defenders that sort of want to deny that there ever even were any problems. And so he's trying to say, no, there were problems, they are real, we need to confront them, but that doesn't mean that we need to sort of abandon the Enlightenment whole scale. It just means that we sort of need to actually instantiate the Enlightenment in its best ideals with the awareness of the dangers that it can bring with it.
On ABC Radio National and ABC Listen, this is The Philosopher's Zone with me, David Rutledge, and this week we're talking about Jürgen Habermas, the great German philosopher who died in March this year. My guest is Peter Voroshek, who recently published an excellent piece on the ABC Religion and Ethics website titled "Did Jürgen Habermas's Death Also Mark the End of His Vision of Democratic Life?" It's well worth a read, and you'll find a link on The Philosopher's Zone website. What I find interesting is his faith in public reasoning and his belief that political power takes its legitimacy from public reasoning rather than simply, you know, the exercise of voting. So tell me more about his thinking there and how it looks in the light of today's public sphere, which increasingly seems to demonstrate the opposite of reason and deliberation.
Yeah, I mean, given sort of any given day you can turn on the television and watch sort of Donald Trump just spew lies, it's very hard to kind of defend the idea of a rational public sphere, to see that as kind of an empirical fact that has been instantiated in any real way. But I think the key thing to understand is that for Habermas, public reason really was a mechanism for democratic legitimacy. And if you look at his early work on the structural transformation of the public sphere, he sort of roots the very self-consciousness of the public as a kind of unified actor that has shared interests vis-a-vis rulers, right? I mean, he's talking about the bourgeois public sphere of the 17th and 18th century, right, where there wasn't necessarily a pre-existing popular consciousness. And at that time, really, the people did not have an identity, and politics was seen as the sphere of the court or the prerogative of the court. And for him, sort of public reason was a way for not only the people to gain that public awareness and to realize that they had not only had an interest in public policy and in politics, but also that they could use their reason and their ability to communicate with each other as a way to sort of not only surveil and sort of see what the government was doing and critique it, but also to push for their own ideas. And not only that from the kind of side of the government, but also then to demand reasons from the government for why they were doing certain things, right? To demand justifications. And so for him, that idea of our own awareness, our ability to participate in politics, even if we don't have a kind of elected position or a formal place in the political system, but also this idea that we as the public have the right to demand reasons from our political officials, that's really at the root of his idea. And in that sense, right, the fact of the kind of seemingly rising unreasonableness of the public sphere, I think also is very useful from a Habermasian perspective in the sense that it shows that something is wrong, right? And that it almost helps us to understand why more and more people are disillusioned by politics, feel that politics does not reflect what they really desire, feel that democracy is increasingly illegitimate. And so I think in that sense, right, as a Habermas's ideas, right, they're not only presenting a kind of ideal of how he thinks the world should function, but they also have this kind of diagnostic function where we can use that ideal as a kind of measuring stick to understand how well we're doing and to diagnose problems. So I think from that perspective, the growing unreasonableness of public discourse actually through Habermas's ideas helps us to understand kind of what is going wrong and to think about it, to really understand why increasingly a lot of us feel that politics is becoming more illegitimate.
But we've been using the word ideal quite a lot here, and I wonder about the idealism of Habermas. Of course, one of the long-standing criticisms of his work has been that, you know, he has this idea of politics that's very much the idea that an academic philosopher would have, which is politics imagined as a sort of endless graduate seminar with everybody politely and patiently sitting around exchanging arguments. How fair is that criticism, would you say?
How well that criticism even captures what a philosophy seminar actually looks like.
That's right.
For anybody who has really been in one, they can actually get quite emotional and sort of there could be quite a lot of antagonism in a philosophy seminar. But regardless of that basic problem, I think, you know, this is a common critique and it's one that really, I think, annoyed Habermas quite a lot. And he said this a number of times. I think his position is not that sort of that that's how politics does work, or even necessarily that that's how politics should work. However, sort of his idea of communicative rationality, there he's really trying to capture the idea that when we're engaging in linguistic interactions, every time I say something, I'm implicitly making certain claims to you. And I'm saying, well, you should believe me when I say that the sky is blue, right? And that if you disagree and say, oh, well, how do you know that? That I'm then, in some sense, if we're going to maintain our linguistic interaction, that I'm then obligated to give you some reasons, right, which you could either accept or reject as to why I think that, right? And I've given a very prosaic example about the state of the world, but Habermas believed that sort of that process was going to be similar if we were talking about sort of my internal states, right, where you could question me if you thought I was lying when I said that I was sad or that I was feeling ill, but also that we could have a similar kind of conversation about norms, right, where sort of we could also say, well, you know, this is the norm that governs our politics. And you might say, well, is that really true? And that we could similarly, that there was almost this obligation if we were going to maintain that interaction for me to give you reasons that you could accept or reject. And so in that sense, I think that's where this idea comes from. But Habermas, even though that's his understanding of sort of linguistic interaction, he never says that that's sort of the way politics should work. He understands, right? I mean, politics is always, it occurs through institutions, and it always occurs under the pressure to make decisions, right? You cannot have kind of endless discussions in politics. But for Habermas, the important thing is that in politics, you have to maintain the same kind of belief in this kind of linguistic interaction and in the idea that we are giving reasons and can question each other. Because for him, even if we're under pressure to decide, the fact that we've gone through that process means that we all realize that those decisions are open to revision, right? Which makes it more likely that if I'm on the losing side of the argument, that I will accept that and sort of hope that I will prevail the next time we discuss whatever issue was under debate. But also he was committed to the idea that sort of even just having that kind of discussion and giving each other those reasons, that even if it didn't lead to sort of consensus or agreement, which he didn't really expect it to, that at the very least it would lead to what he called mutual understanding, right? Where the two of us would at least understand why we thought certain things and why we disagreed, and that we would increasingly recognize each other's humanity. And again, that would be another reason that even if we were on opposite sides of the political spectrum, that we would not see each other as enemies or sort of incomprehensible aliens, but that we would actually have a sense that we were in this project together and realize that we were perhaps both people of goodwill and that we could live together despite our disagreements. So really, I think sort of there is the kind of ideal kind of social theory in the background. But in terms of the political theory, there is a recognition that consensus isn't possible, that we have to reach decisions. But there is still this idea that despite that, we still need to remain committed to giving each other reasons and to sort of acting in a way that is honest and not just sort of falsely sort of claiming certain reasons when those aren't true, right? And engaging in what Habermas called strategic interaction, where sort of I'm giving you false reasons because the reason I'm actually defending a position is because, I don't know, I'm being paid by fossil fuel companies, right? Or whatever the case may be.
He did believe in the authority of the better argument, of course, which I've come to think of as a little bit like free speech, you know, one of those concepts that just looks a little in need of revision in today's communication environment. And of course, politics is about power. And I'm wondering, how did power play into Habermas's analysis of democratic public opinion?
I mean, I think power is an interesting idea, right? Because usually we think about power and force as being somewhat different, right? And force as being something perhaps more raw, more bare, more physical. Whereas power already includes some sense that there's some reasoning behind it, that perhaps there's perhaps some legitimacy behind it. So for Habermas, right, he really does think that he doesn't think that power is a problem, but he thinks that power really should be rooted in what he called the unforced force of the better argument, right? That sort of true power in that sense was really reflected in your ability to sort of provide someone with good reasons and sort of get them on your side. And he thought that that was that good leadership expressed power by being able to do that, right? By being able to say, look, this might be an unpopular position, right? But we really should let the migrants in, right? One of the few cases where he actually said something positive about a right-wing leader, Angela Merkel in this case, was when she let in a million refugees into Germany in 2015, right at the height of the migrant crisis in Europe. And he really saw that as an application of power, because she not only reached a decision that was unpopular for her politically, but also then really engaged in a campaign of trying to convince the citizenry of Germany that this had been the right thing to do. And so that for him was a good application of power, right? He was much more concerned about applications of power that sought to shut down or avoid public debate completely. I think the classic example that maybe some listeners will know of is the example of the Historikerstreit, the historians' debate of the 1980s, where Habermas was very critical of Chancellor Helmut Kohl, who he saw as trying to sort of change the German relationship to the past and to sort of normalize the Holocaust and say, oh, the Holocaust was nothing special. The Holocaust was actually a response to the Gulag and to what was happening in the East, right? And Habermas really saw Kohl's attempts to sort of almost administratively, right, to change the wordings of memorials, to engage in a kind of different foreign policy that was based on the idea that the Holocaust was nothing special without engaging in public debate as a kind of bad application of power, or almost as an application in some sense of force in politics. Right? So for him, power is important, but you always have to sort of think about power as being connected to legitimacy and being connected in the ability to really convince people and provide them with good reasons.
It makes me think of the defense that we often hear put forward these days of the populist strongman, right? And this idea that says, you know, democracy is too slow, nothing gets done. What we need is the kind of ruthless leadership that cuts through all the endless deliberation and takes charge, because these are dangerous times and dangerous times call for decisive action. And of course, that's a narrative that usually posits immigrants and people on the political left as the threat against which the strongman should be allowed to mobilize. But it's also a narrative that could apply to something like climate change or the cost of housing or wealth inequality, where I think a lot of citizens would like to see less talk and more action, even if it meant we had to have some sort of authoritarian leader who could push it all through. What might Habermas have to say about all of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really classic question, right, in terms of sort of the benign philosopher king who would be making the right decisions. I don't think Habermas was blind to sort of the fact that we face real factual problems of climate change, right, and sort of the rise of authoritarianism. But I don't think he thought that you could fight fire with fire in that way. And I think for him also, it was really important that politics is not only or even primarily about sort of reaching decisions and making people's material lives better in some way. Politics in many ways is about identity. It's a reflection of culture and sort of symbolic reproduction. And he was really worried about the idea that these arguments about efficiency and strategic arguments about profit and sort of what would be economically best, that those things were really crowding out politics and really sort of making people feel like they were losing control to kind of the systems of kind of bureaucracy and to the systems of economics that I was already talked about before, right? That increasingly seems to rule our lives. And so for him, the idea of giving over politics to these kind of systemic forces of power and efficiency and profit, while it might lead to maybe some objectively good decisions in the short run, is actually just going to alienate people from politics even further, even more. And in some sense, lead to a growing sense of anomie, right? And actually, in the long run, make things worse for individuals, right? So in that sense, he really maintained to the end, despite all the problems and despite the kind of increasing Unheimlichkeit that he sensed in the world, he maintained his belief that democracy was really capable of solving problems, that it really was the only approach that could solve problems without actually making the fundamental problem of our human being in the world worse. So in that sense, sort of, despite the fact that he maybe would have supported some of the decisions that a kind of divine philosopher king would make, he thought that actually sort of, that they, the long run, that would actually just make the problem worse.
Do you think there's any sense in which Habermas underestimated the power of nationalism? It's an extraordinary thing to wonder given his background, but looking back over the decades since the Second World War, and certainly looking around the world today, nationalism has this persistence that can make it seem a lot stronger than cosmopolitan democracy. And I wonder if in the end, Habermas's optimism might have led him to underestimate the nationalist desires of the modern political subject.
I don't think he underestimated its power. In many ways, I think he was all too aware of it. And really, I think we were just talking about sort of the dangers of authoritarianism and the effects that that has in terms of alienating citizens. And I think he felt that nationalism in the long run, especially in a sort of global multicultural world, was really just going to, again, make things worse by sort of giving people the sense that they could close themselves off, right? That it was possible to sort of be an island, right? And to not have any goods or people crossing borders. And that was possible at a time when he really thought it wasn't. And so in that sense, I think for him, moving towards what the post-national constellation, right, this concept I talked about a little bit earlier, it wasn't just a kind of ideal, but really a necessity for living in the modern world. And arguably, right, I mean, at any given time, I don't think there was ever a golden age where it was less globalized, right? There's a lot of research talking about how actually globalization is not a new phenomenon and that it has existed for a long time and people always cross borders, right? And borders are actually a relatively recent phenomenon, just as actually nationalism, right, in at least the way that we understand it, is a relatively recent phenomenon. So I think sort of Habermas was well aware of its power, but he really saw it as kind of not really fit for purpose, given the kind of conditions of the modern world, and especially given the dangers that it would lead to, because he really thought that sort of the, I guess, very utopian ideas of someone like Giuseppe Mazzini, right, or kind of the nationalist thinkers of the 19th century, where if every people had a nation, there would be peace in the world, right? We all know that nations don't break down on clear borders, right? Where do you stop, right? What is nationalism and what is just regionalism? Nationalism ultimately is not very coherent, and it's still quite dangerous. So Habermas, while aware of its power, really thought that it still needed to be overcome, although he didn't think that we could get rid of national identities. He just thought that he was just hopeful that we could sort of layer them within more cosmopolitan identities, perhaps sort of where you would be not only have a regional identity, right, or sort of a local identity from your city or the town you came from, and maybe a regional identity of the province, a national identity, and then a supranational identity, right, of your region, of the world, or whatever the case may be. He really believed that sort of that nationalism could be harnessed if it could be sort of treated as another identity within a whole set of identities that was not necessarily the primary one or the only one that was politically important for an individual.
He had a very strong commitment to public memory, the importance of public memory. And in particular, he thought that Holocaust memory was, in some sense, foundational for a democratic Europe. Can you tease out his thinking a little there, his thinking on how democracies can survive or whether they can survive the disappearance of living memory of things like the Holocaust?
Yeah, I mean, I think sort of Habermas was very committed to the idea of learning from catastrophe, right? And that's an idea that he drew from Theodor Adorno, who he called his one true teacher, even though formally he had received his doctorate before he met Adorno. Right? And so this idea of learning from catastrophe was really important to him in the sense that the key for him after an experience like the Holocaust was that you could almost measure politics by one criterion, and that was whether you repeated that experience, right? Or whether you were able to avoid it in the future. And so again, right, I mean, for him, the Holocaust is that kind of central moral catastrophe for Germany, which, yeah, is a warning against nationalist tendencies. It's a warning against sort of trying to eliminate individuals from the body politic, right, of the dangers of sort of denationalization, right? There are any number of these kind of political trends that we now see on the rise again today that he really saw as rooted in this experience. And for him, in that sense, it was key to German democracy, especially because it was only after that experience and the reckoning of that experience that Germany was able to form a stable democratic government, right? I mean, the Weimar Constitution was the first real democratic government in Germany, but it wasn't very stable, right? It was undermined very quickly during the interwar years. And so in that sense, memory was key for Germany, but Habermas thought that sort of that memory was key everywhere, right? That the German case was not singular in the way that it needed to learn from the past, right? So he thought the Holocaust and the confrontation of that and learning from it, that that was a model that other countries could follow in learning from dark chapters of their history. But for him, there was also a sense that the Holocaust, in how mechanized it was, in how effective it was, especially in sort of the way that it really used bureaucratic procedures in a kind of really efficient way to eliminate individuals that the Third Reich had decided were no longer wanted, that in that sense, it reflected a lot of kind of the negative potentials of modern society and modern structures, both economic and political. And in that sense, he thought that there was a potential for other countries to kind of do what, I mean, Susan Nyman has referred to this as learning from the Germans, right? That even countries that had not experienced the Holocaust, that bore no responsibility, no moral shame for the Holocaust, could still learn from Germany and learn from that experience and perhaps avoid having to have that, having to have a similar catastrophe for which to learn. So in that sense, I think sort of, again, you get into this dialectic of the universal in particular, where his thought is very much rooted in the particular German experience. But then also he thought that you could kind of draw universal conclusions from that experience that other people could learn from.
Well, toward the end of your essay, you suggest that we may have reached the end of Habermas's world. Does that mean we need another political philosopher for the age that's dawning? Or is it more the case that we've failed to live up to Habermas's ideas and we should be reading him all the more closely?
I think you can. It's not going to surprise anyone that I'm going to say the latter. Habermas was always in the minority, right? Despite sort of being broadly recognized as, in Germany as the most important philosopher, that wasn't a reflection of the fact that everyone agreed with him. In fact, he was always kind of a red flag, especially for conservatives, but also often was attacked by other sort of people within the left, which is where he positioned himself. So in that sense, right, I mean, I don't think we can measure his impact in sort of how people agreed with him. But I do think that we will need new political philosophers to sort of help us to understand our current moment, to help us theorize and diagnose what we are experiencing today. And that's not to say that sort of we can just blindly follow Habermas, but I think that, as I hope what I've said in this interview has made clear, I think that Habermas does still provide us with some valuable tools, some diagnostic tools for thinking about what some of the problems are, even if maybe we want to depart from some of his substantive conclusions, or even if we feel like some of his ideals require revision. I still think that sort of at a time when we do seem to be seeing the rise of a kind of mute power politics, right? Where increasingly sort of you had Stephen Miller, right, talk about almost rephrasing the famous ideas from the Melian dialogue, right, of the strong do what they will and the weak suffer what they must. That I think at a time like that, I think Habermas's work does give us a way to think about what is really wrong and short-sighted about that way of thinking and how that way of thinking actually is not going to resolve the anomie and the alienation that a lot of Trump voters and voters for authoritarian movements elsewhere feel, but it's actually just going to make it worse because it is, again, every superpower, right, realizes that ultimately there's a limit to their power, right, as I think sort of the U.S. experience in Iran right now is demonstrating. And so ultimately, we can only function politically and find meaning in the world together with others. And doing that inevitably, so we are linguistic beings, will always be a linguistic experience. And I think if we cede ever more parts of our lives to kind of these systems of efficiency, of profit, and that drives, not, comes to drive not only our politics, but also our personal relationships, right? We now have people, dating sites talking about the marriage market, right? That's very unlikely to sort of make us feel any better about ourselves and our society. And in fact, it's just likely to make us feel worse. And I think ultimately sort of the ideas that Habermas has that our experience as human beings is inevitably rooted in language and in our attempts to try to understand each other and to reach mutual understanding, I think really probably provides us with a better way out than those who just want to say, we just need to accept power and that will sort of resolve the problems of the world.
Well, that wraps it up nicely. Peter Voroshek, it's been great to talk and thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Peter Voroshek, he's Senior Assistant Professor in the History and Theory of European Integration at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. And his essay, Did Jürgen Habermas's Death Also Mark the End of His Vision of Democratic Life, is available on the ABC Religion and Ethics website. You'll find a link on our website, which is, of course, the Philosopher's Zone. This episode of The Philosopher's Zone was produced on the lands of the Bundjalung people by me, David Rutledge. Thanks so much for your company, and I hope you can join me next time. Bye for now.